Ms. O'Malley, sorry.
Okay. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the Court. This is the dinner party case. This is the case that you talk about at the dinner party with your friends and neighbors who aren't lawyers. They're from all different walks of life. And you tell them about this university that has this department that has never, in 115 years, once promoted a female to a tenured position. And you tell them that they couldn't, even if they were ordered or instructed to do so, because they don't even have a single woman in a tenure-eligible position, not one. You tell them that your client, who was a nationally recognized scientist with 23 peer-reviewed published papers, 14 of which were in leading journals, more than any of the men who were tenured in the same time frame as her had ever published in leading journals, was not given tenure. You tell them how the department committee, who knew her best, knew her work, and knew the field best, unanimously and enthusiastically.
But weren't all but one of those papers written when she was in Boston before she came to Northwestern?
The majority of those papers were written in Boston, and those papers should have...
All but one.
Yes. There was one paper that was written in Northwestern.
So in her time at Northwestern, she was not productive. I mean, I know there are reasons, but she wasn't, right?
I believe that my client...
I would count a lot with these people.
What counts a lot with these people, according to Dean Young, is the quality of papers, not the quantity. And that was conceded by the defendant. Dr. Blaisdell had a reputation...
Hello. You don't want to overstate that.
Well,
if one person writes 100 papers, another person writes one paper, the fact that the one paper is better than 100 doesn't actually mean that this is a better researcher, right?
That's not the record we have here. And there are two points to make on that issue, Judge. One is both Dr. Bevan and Dr. Blaisdell had 23 papers. Dr. Blaisdell had 14 of her 23 published in top-tier journals.
About this, I mean, the problem is her output fell off very drastically after she left Boston.
The issue, Judge, is that the reason she was given the shortest tenure clock, as purported by defendant says the reason that she has a four-year clock as opposed to the six-year or better clocks of every male in the department is because of the fact that she has all of this body of work from Boston. So how do you justify, then, that they would refuse to consider that work? So the reality is she has to submit her tenure application after three years at Northwestern.
When they gave her the 4 years, it's because she already had 8 years in Boston. So you'd think, well, that would certainly provide, you know, relevant evidence. But if in the 4 years she doesn't produce or produces very little, then they might decide, well, she was great when she was in Boston, but something has happened and she's not productive anymore.
Well, first, Judge, 4 years isn't 4 years. It's three, because you have to submit your tenure application.
Did she object to being given the four-year deadline?
At the time that she was given the 4 years, Dr. Surmeyer told her that he absolutely supported her for tenure. He was going to ensure that she was tenured. What she had no idea of was at that very time, simultaneous to that, behind her back, he was telling the provost, no, we shouldn't consider Dr. Blaisdell for tenure right now because I want her to prove herself. And he was giving the message that he was giving to the provost was directly opposite of what he was telling Dr. Blaisdell. That duplicity in and of itself is evidence of pretext from which the jury can look at Dr. Surmeyer and say, this is an individual who has never hired another female, who's never put a female on a search committee, who has passed over every single other female, who has referred to female scientists as female scientists who reproduced. When I asked
I don't understand... the way you put it, female scientists who reproduce. This is the way scientists talk, right? But what he meant by it was innocent, which is that if you have ordinarily a woman, could be a man, but ordinarily a woman, who has, you know, child care responsibilities and so on, you give that person a break. There's nothing wrong with that.
Respectfully, Judge, that's for the jury to decide. The courts have said...
Wait a second. I don't understand that. a scientist who reproduces. There's nothing. I mean, it's a funny way to talk about it, right? It's a funny phrase, but it's not evidence of discrimination. When what you mean by it is that these scientists who reproduce have to be given, additional consideration because they don't have as much time to spend on scientific work.
She wasn't given additional consideration. This notion that these comments that were made over and over throughout her employment and at every single step...
Comments made over and over again.
First of all, throughout her employment, she was referred to a female scientist who reproduced. When she wanted to discuss her science, Dr. Schirmer said to her, "I understand you have this emotional need to be heard." This isn't the way he talks to or about the male colleagues. Most importantly, Judge...
Well, how do you know? I don't understand that.
Pardon me?
How do you know he doesn't ever refer to a male as having an emotional need to be heard?
Well, there's no testimony, there's nothing in the record that suggests that he does, and you can compare the way that he talks about Dr. Bevan versus the way that he talks about Dr. Schirmer, Dr. Blaisdell, in the very tenure letters when he doesn't recommend Dr. Blaisdell for tenure in his initial letter. At every step, the first thing that he does is say that here's this female scientist. She's a primary caregiver of two young boys. These are enormous demands placed on her time, with the boys having difficulty transitioning to public school. Great deal of stress on the family, the flagging career of her husband. Much promise has not been realized, largely because of the demands associated with raising two young boys, moving her family to Chicago. And he even goes to...
Sounds discriminatory, and he did recommend that she be given tenure.
He didn't recommend that she be given tenure in that letter. He did not. He recommended that she be promoted to a position that she had held for 3 years. He didn't even know her rank when he wrote this letter. It was only after Dean Young said to him, and he recommended that they promote her to a position she already held and that they maybe give her some more time. And Dean Young said, family responsibilities is not a legitimate reason to give somebody more time. And you need to resubmit this letter. And his response was, well, if there's no easy path for her to get more time, I just won't bother. And at the end of the day...
I thought the department, which includes Schirmer, supported her.
The Schirmer's letter is a very different... It's step one.
I thought your position had to be that the Schirmer letter recommending tenure after the one that recommended postponement was in essence a kind of damning with faint praise.
Well, that's,
is that right?
That's exactly right. I mean, he
doesn't. Let me ask you: How do you wind up attributing sex bias in this case to the final decision makers, the provost, dean, and medical school committee?
Well, first of all, the law is very clear and has been both from the Supreme Court as well as this court that those comments can be attributed where the review board is tainted. But more importantly...
Wait a second. Slow down.
Pardon me, sure.
I mean, I understand your point about the ambiguity and jury being able to weigh what was meant by the various references to Dr. Blaisdell's gender within the department. But at the level of the final decision makers, dean, provost, with the recommendation from the medical school committee against tenure, how does a jury find that that final decision was based on sex?
The jury finds that because at every substantive layer of the tenure review, these comments that Schirmer threw out there, Schirmer dressed up her tenure application in a big pink bow, and it called her a mother and a woman and a female scientist, and he didn't focus on her science, and he tied those things to productivity, and that shows up in every single layer.
Well,
and this is
against Northwestern. Now, if he deceived his superiors, you know, that's our cat's paw case. But if the superiors know what he are not deceived, but they just decide, looking at everything, that she shouldn't be given tenure, how is the university responsible?
Under the law, there doesn't have to be an act of deceit. If the comments themselves that are tied to her productivity form the basis for the reviewers to evaluate her on illegal criteria, which when they're talking about her gender, even at this FSM APT, the demands of her family in a discussion about her productivity.
But suppose this case, suppose the university gets, it's a simpler case, suppose the university gets recommendations from the department to promote a person for tenure, and then gets some negative information, but it's entirely non-discriminatory. And then finally, it hears from someone who says, well, I'm against her because she's a woman. And suppose the university decides to deny her tenure. But the fact that they knew that some underling was hostile to her doesn't mean that they were discriminating, right? You couldn't automatically ascribe this discriminatory subordinate's opinion to the university because they had other information to go on, right?
Well, it depends on the facts of the case. In this case, we not only have
What about my case?
In your case, there's one underling who makes one comment after a decision about her productivity has already been made.
I state my case. Answer my case. Mine was clear. And you're doctoring it.
I apologize, Judge. I don't mean to doctor your case.
This is a situation in which the people making the decision, the deans and what have you, they receive an abundance of pro and con, non-discriminatory, favorable and unfavorable information about a candidate. And they also receive what is obviously some sort of discriminatory antipathy to her from someone else. That's part of the information they receive.
The issue in your case would be the same as the issue in this case, which is what is the record as a whole?
In my case, you cannot attribute a discriminatory motive to the people making the decision just because there was some discriminatory expression in the materials they looked at.
And that may be if there was not other evidence, such as the profound statistics in the department, the fact that the profound statistics of a total exclusion of women in the department, the fact that the chair who made those statistics worse.
The dean was aware of that, right? Aware of all
of course, the dean is aware of the statistics in the Department of Physiology.
But there are other reasons. If there are other reasons which have nothing to do with discrimination for denying her tenure, and the dean denies her tenure, how do you show that the dean's decision was based on or influenced by the discrimination?
You show that by the evidence in this case. Those comments followed her throughout the entire tenure review process against
but
the backdrop.
There was other information that the dean, maybe the dean, you know, is. He's very concerned about the fact that she hasn't been publishing recently. I mean, the problem with tenure, of course, you don't give tenure to someone on the basis of publication if you have reason to believe that once the person gets tenure, he or she isn't going to publish anymore. That's the beauty of tenure. You know, you get a lot of dead wood with tenure. That's the criticism of a tenure system.
Of course, if I may.
Besides us, right? We have tenure. But the problem with tenure is that some people will use tenure as an excuse for taking it easy.
And that is not the evidence in this case. If not only did Dr. Blaisdell have the unanimous, enthusiastic support of the six colleagues in her department, which is separate than Surmeyer, who said that she easily meets and she exceeds tenure, she had the support of the next layer of review, the ad hoc committee on a unanimous basis. She also had the support, overwhelming support, of the external reviewers.
So the people running Northwestern University don't like to have women professors?
I believe that the Department of Physiology has a total exclusion of women. It's a sex-segregated department.
Okay,
Dr. Surmeyer made this worse.
Who makes the final decision on tenure?
The decision is made by a reviewing board. And if I could just add, because I'd like
now
to...
The reviewing board...
Layers of review. And my if I could just add before...
So what's who makes the decision?
The decision is made at the first step by the...
Look, you don't make a decision at the first step. You make a recommendation at the first step.
Well, ultimately, the provost.
Who makes the final decision?
Ultimately, the provost makes the final decision after the several layers of review go up, and he makes that decision based on their recommendation.
What's your evidence that the provost has discriminatory motive in making that decision? Was he deceived, or is he, or what?
Your Honor, this tenure application was presented in a manner that you couldn't separate.
So he was deceived? Is that your theory? He couldn't separate what
from what. I'm not going to use the word deceived.
Well,
I'm going to use the word discriminated against.
Because if he wasn't deceived, then I don't see how you have a case.
Well, if what you're asking me to say is he's lying, I don't know that I, you know, maybe we're using that word differently.
Your theory is that he has a biased recommendation, a very faint, tepid recommendation from the department chairman that basically says this is, implies very clearly that this is a weak application. Right?
Yes.
And if that was based on gender, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but that's your theory, right?
Yes, and when in fact the evidence reveals that her application was very solid on its merits, as recognized by a number of people, she only had 3 years, the jury would have to ask itself, why didn't they consider the work she did at Boston if they told her the justification for not giving her more time at the outset was because we were going to consider that work? The jury would have to ask itself, but for these comments suggesting that a mother of young children couldn't be productive, would these evaluators have looked at her tenure application in this matter? And we suggest that there's countervailing evidence that absolutely they wouldn't.
Okay, thank you. Your time is long expired. But it's our fault. Okay, Ms. Wormuth?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Anna Wormuth on behalf of the university. And I think your questioning today has put the nail in the coffin here.
Only one side has been questioned so far.
You're right. You're right about that. But I would like to focus on the comments because that there is a lot of evidence in this record about comments that were made. None of the comments are legally sufficient as evidence of gender discrimination. You have one set of comments that are nothing other than stray remarks.
Sounds a lot like a jury argument. Let me ask you, if I could, about the refusal to consider Dr. Blasdell's appeal. I don't understand the letter that says your appeal does not sufficiently allege grounds of appeal within the stated jurisdiction of the university appeals panel. I thought it was pretty clear. She said, I would want to appeal this decision on the basis of gender discrimination.
She does say that, Your Honor, in her appeal letter. But what she also says in her letter is that she believes that the gender discrimination did not occur within the confines of the tenure process.
Where did
in the
she say
review.
That?
And I'm sorry, I don't actually have that letter with me. But she
I have it in front of me.
Okay.
She didn't disclaim that. It may not be. It's a short letter. It's not a full appellate brief
right,
with all the
right.
relevant evidence.
That's right.
But how on earth is that something that the university would not even consider and then took 7 months to say, we're not even going to consider this?
Well, again, the committee that hears those appeals is separate and apart. So the refusal or the decision that the appellate body didn't have jurisdiction to hear it was made by a faculty member in the School of Music, obviously not
part of the University.
Certainly, yes.
You're not disclaiming responsibility for that committee's actions, are you?
I'm not. No,
okay.
It certainly was a university member. It was a tenure faculty member in the School of Music who had Dr. Blasdell's letter and had the department's letter through Dr. Young, I believe, and in reviewing that information decided that it didn't state a ground for appeal because it didn't contest the tenure decision or the process for the tenure decision. That was the conclusion.
Did they review the entire file?
That is not in the record, Your Honor.
Was there any follow-up to say, what do you mean?
She was not brought in for questioning, no.
Let me ask you about the treatment of her experience at Boston University.
Okay.
Recalling that we're here on summary judgment,
right.
So that the plaintiff gets the benefit of these kinds of ambiguities and uncertainties. But the plaintiff makes a pretty strong point, frankly, when they suggest that her BU experience was counted against her in deciding whether she had had enough time to prepare for a tenure application, but didn't seem to be considered in evaluating her overall performance and productivity with the five-year limit that was imposed. Have I misunderstood the evidence there?
I think you have, and I think if you look at the APT committee's report in reviewing her
is this the department or the
I'm sorry, the medical school APT report. If you review that report.
Where do we find that one?
I will tell you momentarily. Forgive me, I seem to not have that report either. But what you can tell from that report, and I won't get you the record site, but what I can tell you from that report is that her entire record was reviewed, including her time at Boston University. And part of the concern that was articulated by the APT committee was that not only had she not been productive at Northwestern University, but that unevenness in her productivity was demonstrated at earlier points in her career as well.
So what about the five-year limit on her application?
She was provided with a form. First of all, she didn't limit her application to 5 years. She included every single publication dating back to the 1980s on her CV that she submitted in connection with the dossier. And in her personal narrative statement, she goes well beyond the 5 years as well. She submitted a lengthy personal narrative that goes back to the beginnings of her education as a very young student. So she certainly didn't limit it to the 5 years.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
Does the defense contend it is an undisputed fact here that Dr. Blasdell was not qualified for tenure?
Yes.
Okay. How can that be undisputed in light of Surmeyer's letter recommending tenure and the departmental committee enthusiastically recommending her for tenure?
That can be reconciled by the fact that in these tenure review decisions, reasonable minds among scholars can differ.
Well,
that
sounds
argue.
To me like a jury problem, right?
You don't want to argue that she is or is not qualified for tenure. You want to argue that there was enough reason to deny tenure that you can't infer that there must have been some invidious attempt, right? There are lots of great bitter disappointments in denial of tenure and injustices in denial of tenure and in grants of tenure, right? It's obvious.
It's a process
riven with mistakes. The question is whether the case against her tenure was so feeble that there must have been something else going on besides a consideration of the merits of her work and promise. Isn't that the issue?
It certainly is the issue. I mean, I think the university's position, obviously, is that she was not qualified for tenure. That is the decision that the university made in connection with her tenure application.
When you put it that way, I don't think that's the way these things work.
You don't want to get into a situation where disagreement within the university automatically produces a jury issue.
Certainly.
And that's where you're headed.
Yeah.
Much of your argument, counsel, depends upon Dr. Surmeyer's endorsement of her application for tenure. If we read these two letters, the ones he wrote to Dr. Young on September 22nd of 06 and on October 1 of 2006, and note that his email when Young told him that tenure had been denied, that this was, quote, not unexpected. It's pretty hard to see this as full-throated endorsement from Dr. Surmeier.
Well, let's take a look at the first letter, the September 22nd mm-hmm. letter. That was Dr. Surmeier's attempt to obtain additional time for Dr.
Right.
Blasdell. It was a draft. He sent it to the Faculty Affairs Office, which is where Dr. Young sits. Dr. Young is not the dean of the medical school.
Surmeier had mixed feelings about her, right?
He
sometimes he thought she was promising, other times not. So what? I don't know what relevance that has to the case. The question is whether in failing, let's call it failing to support her wholeheartedly or change his mind about her or acting inconsistently, it was because she was a woman.
I agree with you that there's no evidence in that regard. But what's important about that September letter is it never becomes part of her dossier. It does not go to the other reviewing committees. Dr. Young sends it back and says, I can't accept this. You need to redo your letter. And so the letter that Dr. Surmeier puts together in October is hardly tepid. I mean, in that letter, I'm sorry?
Let's see. Although her publication record in the last 3 years has not been stellar, there are mitigating circumstances. In summary, Dr. Mintz is an excellent young female neuroscientist with an outstanding record of accomplishment and great scientific promise. Much of that promise has not been realized, largely because of unanticipated impediments. This sounds like a torpedo, isn't it? Or maybe I don't know the code. What's the code here?
It's not a torpedo. She submitted a CV that shows a four-year gap in her publication record.
Judge Hamilton is correct. That's a death sentence. But I don't know that. I don't think that affects the case at all. Whether he's for tenure, not for tenure. Think she's fulfilled her promise? Not think it wrong, right? I mean, the question is whether hostility to women and not wanting to break the all-male record of his department was a motivation, right? That's what you have to deal with. And your opponent, I mean, really is fascinating on, you know, the reproducing comment and the emotional need comment, right?
Which are comments that the reviewing committees never heard.
Pardon?
Reviewing committees never heard.
No, but they got this letter from the author of those comments, right?
They did get this letter. And by the way, in this letter, what Dr. Surmeier puts here with respect to her lack of productivity in the Udall Center was precisely what Dr. Blasdell had asked to use in connection with the request.
Lack of promise. The failure to fulfill the promise. Very damaging in a tenure review, because the expectations, I mean, there's a lot of dishonesty in this business, but the expectations are rave recommendations, right? And they're discounted. But if they're not rave recommendations, if they have a negative streak, that's very, very damaging. But I don't know why you fight over this, because all you have to do is show that a reasonable jury couldn't find that Surmeier's motivations were discriminatory, right? As long as he was trying to make or saying this or was giving the same sort of recommendation that he would have made to an identically situated about an identically situated male, then there's no case against Northwestern.
And your point is well taken, because there is
that's of course why your opponents makes a lot of, you know, trying to compare how she was treated with how Bevan was treated, right? She regards them as comparable. Bevan is male, he's treated better. That's kind of her case, right? So what's wrong with that?
Well, there are a couple of things wrong with that. First of all, yes, they were in the same department. Yes, they reported to the same chair. Yes, they went up for tenure at the same time. But their records are not directly comparable, which is what the law requires. Or at least similar. She was significantly more senior than him in terms of how long she had been in academia and in independent research positions significantly longer than he.
How much longer?
Well, she was at Boston for 8 years before coming to Northwestern University, and even in her deposition claims that she had a tenured position in Europe prior to that for some number of years. So she's a decade into her career as an independent researcher. Meanwhile, Dr. Bevin is 3 years into his career as an independent scientist by the time that he comes to Northwestern University. So in terms of their number of publications, if you want to look at just an objective number, they've both got 23, but hers are 23 over a longer period of time than
his.
What
about the proposition that her publications, although fewer, less frequent publications, were in superior journals, line, they were better papers?
Right. That's where I think this court should draw the line, and that's where this court has drawn the line in other tenure cases. When it comes down to just comparing qualifications against qualifications, the Namerworth case in particular says the plaintiff is bound to lose in that circumstance, because the court here should not be deciding. I mean, we're talking about very fine distinctions between competent scholars and excellent scholars.
Suppose we're talking about competent salesmen and excellent salesmen. I mean, is there a different rule of law that applies here, a different version of Rule 56?
Well, the rule that this court has always stated is that it's not going to sit as a super personnel department, obviously. And in the context of tenure decisions, this circuit has also taken the position that when it comes down to determining whether or not someone's paper is better than someone else's paper, or that the scholarship...
The proposition was that that Bevin had published in less prestigious journals. There is a pecking order of journals in all these fields. Is there any? Did the plaintiff present any evidence to support the proposition that her journals were, that she published in the higher quality journals?
There is no question that she published in a number of high impact journals. Dr. Bevin also published.
They use these impact measures of relative quality of journals?
I would not say necessarily that those, it certainly is not something that the APT relied upon when they wrote up their comments about the decision-making process. But keep in mind, too, that it was not just a matter of publication.
The evidence in the case.
I thought it was pretty, there's nothing that I saw that's quite, sort of that gives us the pecking order. But it's pretty extensively discussed by the outside references and the internal letters, isn't it?
It certainly is. And, of course, Dr. Blasdell herself testified, and in taking her testimony as true, she certainly did have papers in high-impact journals. And, in fact, Dr. Surmeyer mentions those papers and talks about their high quality in his letter of recommendation. So certainly the evidence is that she published in high-quality journals. She also was incapable, however, of sustaining extramural funding. And at the end of the day, we're talking about lifetime employment, where there's no evidence that she can sustain her position financially at the institution.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Wormuth.
Thank you for your
time. So, Ms. O'Malley, your time had expired, but you can have another minute if you'd like.
Surmeyer's deposition testimony, I believe it's pages 87 through 90 and 11 and 12, describes which journals are the high-end journals for the scientific community, and you can compare those with Bevin and Miller's CVs. Lee Miller had zero papers in high-impact journals. He was also a male who was tenured in the same time frame. The cat's paw theory, Judge, don't believe it's quite as restrictive as was set forth when I was first up here. That theory has been applied to tenure cases. The Stern case in the Sixth Circuit, and there was a recent case out of the Eastern District of Michigan that was decided last week, denying a motion to dismiss, expressly stating in a denial of tenure that a chair's recommendation can sully the whole thing. In this case...
What was the Michigan case?
Do
you have a name?
It's... BIAYAS, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
And going back to the comments, I want to make sure that this isn't just the emotional need to be heard in the female scientist who has babies. These comments are in the 10-year process. They go all the way up the line. They were so woven into her 10-year application. This is for the jury to decide if, but for those comments and that cloud of you're a mom, you're a woman, that affects your productivity. It's so woven in there that it's impossible to unweave it. And that's a question for the jury to decide based on the evidence in this case. The profound statistics, the zero women in the department, it's a total exclusion of women. The cases are all supportive. That is evidence of discrimination. We cannot have what I believe defendant seems to be arguing for is the department APT committee is not just tenure. It's appointment, which is hire, promotion, and tenure. And so every personnel decision that is made in a university and at Northwestern University is subject to this multi-layer review process. So
it's just to satisfy my greedy self, what does the job pay?
What does the job pay? It depends on...
This job I'm talking about, the job that your client has got, what does it pay?
Dr. Blaisdell, if I don't recall precisely, but it was maybe around $90,000 a year.
How much?
$90,000 per year. You get funding for your lab. She had $500,000 of funding. The males were given $600,000 of funding. And from that funding, you're able to take interest-free loans to help you get situated and to draw your salary from those funding sources as well. And that's part of the evidence in the case that Dr. Bevan was given funding from Dr. Surmeyer. Dr. Surmeyer shared funding with Dr. Bevan that he didn't share with Dr. Blaisdell. So between the disparate treatment, the pervasive comments that went all the way up the ladder for her tenure review, and the total exclusion of women, we think that a jury can find. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you to both counsel.
Thank you very much, Judge.
Taking under advisement.